And you are listening to KRFP Moscow. This is the Wild Clearwater Country Show. We're just starting. It's about 4 o'clock. And first, the weather. We've got quite a good show for you here. We'll talk about it here in just a minute. It looks like a 30% chance of showers this evening, tonight. Mostly cloudy, they're saying, today, although it doesn't look that too bad out there right now for the late afternoon. And tomorrow, about a 30% chance of showers. Tomorrow night and tonight, the lows would be in the mid-40s, highs in lower 60s, and that it will be projected to be partly sunny on Friday, highs in the mid-60s. But Friday night, about a 20% chance of showers and a 30% of showers on Saturday night, and increasing to 40% on Sunday. Highs are going to be in the mid to lower 60s, and lows are going to be in the 40s. Right now, it's about 61 degrees at the Moscow Pullman Airport. So there you have it. What we're going to do is going to start off the show today. I've got a special guest here who is... his name's Harry Jagman. Hello, Harry.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Doing all right. We're going to get everything adjusted here on the microphones. And Harry is a former wildlife biologist with the Forest Service. He's retired, but you've got your PhD in wildlife now. Is that right? Or you're getting it?
In progress.
In progress. Okay, so here we go. We're going to take a little quick musical break while we check some levels. We've been having some things being fixed here in the studio, and I thought this would be an appropriate song given the topic we're going to discuss today, and it's called You Can't Clear Cut Your Way to Heaven. So here we go with some music on KRFB.
Now the Lord made the world in just 6 days. A wonder to behold when it was done. Deep oceans and blue skies, forests green and mountains high, with animals that crawl and fly and run. But one of God's creatures wasn't pleased. It wanted to create with its own hands. So it clear cut all the trees, carved the mountains, spoiled the seas, proclaiming it the way that God had planned. But you can't clear cut your way to heaven. Those strip mines don't make it with the Lord. For all those in the creation, may close forevermore. Now my mama used to read the family Bible, and it said, thou shalt not covet, steal, or kill. And then I coveted the forests and the mountains, yes I did. Mother Nature's gems at will, and I killed off many critters to extinction. But then I'm sure God must have made them by mistake, 'cause I had to keep my job where I plunder, rape, and rob. But I swear to you, it's for my children's sake. But you can't clear cut your way to heaven. No strip mines don't make it with the Lord. All those in the creation won't win God's admiration, and the pearly gates may close forevermore. Well, today I heard they mined the Rock of Ages, 'cause they thought it had cold inside. And they're dumping PCBs into the Sea of Galilee. And they build the cross on which our Savior died. And they've leveled old Jerusalem for condos. And unbuilt the shopping mall where Jesus did his thing. And as I looked on our success at creating such a mess, I swore I heard a band of angels sing.
No, you can't feel a terrain. No surprise or banger with the Lord. Bulldozing a creation, walking God's apparition.
Back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. We've got Harry Jagman in here. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about, a giant timber sale that has been proposed. The draft environmental impact statement is out now for public comment. It's called Clear Creek Integrated Restoration Project. I love the title. It's one of the most ironic titles I've ever heard. Seems like most of the, quote, restoration in this area has already taken place since they've taken out some roads in the past. Of course, now I'm going to be building some more. Of course, they are supposedly temporary. So, Harry, what's sort of your take on this, the kind of an overview from this giant timber sale? And if people, of course, want to comment, I would refer them to the Friends of the Clearwater website, and that will give you information on where you can go, or you can look this up online. Comments are due, I believe, June 3rd on this very, very, very large timber sale.
Well, Gary, you know, I think the Forest Service heard your song there. Mm-hmm. Instead of clear-cutting their way to heaven, nowadays they're going to restore their way to heaven. These guys, everything is, there is no more logging. It's all restoration. It doesn't matter what happens. As long as you leave a few trees out there, the forest will be great, according to the Forest Service. And now we have a collaborative group working with the Forest Service called the Clearwater Basin Collaborative. And those guys are supposed to be working to come up with compromise solutions. Well, the compromise solution that they've come up with is the biggest timber sale the Clearwater and Nez Perce Forest has seen in probably 40 years.
Yeah, that's right.
And I mean, so that's the way to compromise in my book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, somebody once told me compromise is great if you can get everything you want from the other side. And that seems to be what's happening here. We have some groups that have been participating in this process. And basically, my take on it is they're giving away the farm. Our big project here is smoke and mirrors, Gary. That's pretty much what I see.
Okay, so from a big picture standpoint, this is a massive timber sale. It's going to log anywhere from 60 something million board feet to 85 million board feet. Now, I'm going to put this in context. The infamous Cove Mallard timber sales back about 20 years ago, and they were two separate projects there. There was the Cove EIS and the Mallard EIS. They were about 80 million or 70 million board feet, somewhere in that neighborhood. This one is one, and it's going to be that size. Wow. I mean, that's all I can say is wow.
Yeah, I got to agree, Gary. The other interesting thing, if you start getting into this document, you find some very interesting things that the Forest Service is going to do to make it happen. For example, They have the regional office in the Forest Service has soil guidelines, which are basically designed to protect the soil so we can grow trees into the future and keep them growing again. Well, it just so happens that several proposed units on this proposed timber sale won't meet the regional soil standard. So what does the Forest Service do? Instead of trying to restore, supposedly this is restoration, but instead of trying to restore the soil, they're more worried about the trees. Their idea is that we'll just cut the timber off of these degraded areas and we'll restore them later. The check will be in the mail for the restore. They're going to change the forest regional rules to a new rule that's just applicable for this little project area. And that way they can get around the regional soil standard. It's great business.
So what they're going to do is they're going to amend the project, it sounds like, for just this specific one, so they will be able to get around that and try to.
That's right, Gary. They'll amend the forest plan, which is the guiding document that directs how the forest can be managed on a broad scale, like the whole Nez Perce National Forest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So they're going to try to make a forest plan, a soil amendment here, and it's one of the concerns that we have with that is that, they've got some serious problems. When I've been leafing through this EIS, and it's a couple hundred pages long for people that actually want to go out and look at it. It talks about landslide prone areas. And places that have, soil that could be compacted, and the volcanic ash cap soil, which is a very, very productive soil, and they're supposed to remain below 50% soil disturbance and the regional standards. And it's interesting in their category design. They have got, of their units, and this is one of the things I can't believe, they've got 22 units that are already over their standards. So they've already damaged these areas already. There's 22 units that are over standard. Units that would exceed the 15% standard in here in this document on in these various alternatives. It looks like there's going to be 25 of them that they're going to exceed the standard by their project. I mean,
yeah. If you don't like the rules, just change them, Gary. That's the way the Forest Service does it.
Unfortunately, but when you were there, I think one of the things that I appreciated in the past is a lot of times the Forest Service, not so much now, would actually, rather than call a timber sale a restoration project, they would say it's a timber sale and the reason we're doing it is for economic purposes, et cetera, et cetera. And then they would reveal the effects of the sale. And yeah, there was a lot of argument, and there was still some quibbling over whether or not a sale should go forth or what units. But nothing like anything on this scale that, they're just exceeding their soil standards, and they're amending their plan, saying, well, maybe that's okay. And I'm wondering how they're going to meet their, the requirement in the law. The Forest Service is not able to change the law that the National Forest Management Act that requires them to maintain soil productivity, and that's right in the law itself. So that could be a challenge right there to this project.
Yeah, Gary, this is a productive area, and some timber harvest probably is reasonable in this area. We all use the forest, and we need use the wood products and all that kind of stuff. And it's probably a logical place for some timber harvests, but the scale of this thing is 4 or 5 times what the Forest Service would have proposed prior to the collaborative group. It's a pretty small drainage. It's less than 44,000 acres, and that's a lot of volume, a lot of open roads that will be needed for all the timber volume. I think there's over 100 miles of road that will be reopened up, and the associated logging act. So this is a big deal. And it seems to be the way the Forest Service is heading with their collaborative process of involving a very small segment of the public. And a lot of times the people they're involving in these decisions have a vested interest in moving forward with big projects like this. Lots of timber company representatives are involved in the collaborative group. County commissioners, other people that really want to make some money off the forest. And that's what this is about.
Okay, so, wow. I think you summarized the size and some of the concerns with it from particularly like from a soil standpoint. We're going to talk about some other issues here as well that are threatened. But getting back to the size of this sale, one of the things that I've noticed is that the Forest Service now, rather than trying to kind of keep at logging at a level that it has been, which is, you know, because of, you know, real resource constraints, the Forest Service was logging since, you know, maybe the mid-90s, late 90s at a certain level, and now they're trying to double the logging rates here on these two national forests. And it seems like the chief of the Forest Service is trying to do the same thing. He's trying to increase, at least by a certain factor, around 40%, the logging on the national forests. And that's, I'm not sure that's necessarily a good thing, that can be done without affecting things like soil, like we're hearing about the soil damage that would occur here, or water quality.
It's a pretty tough place for water quality too, Gary. Most of the streams here aren't meeting the forest plan standards once again for water quality. And the forest has a rule where if the project is showing an upward trend in improving watershed conditions, then more logging can be scheduled. Unfortunately, the Forest Service here hasn't really taken the time and energy to go out and document whether the streams are on a positive upward trend or not. They haven't done any surveys in the stream for 20 years. They say, trust us, we're going to do a good job, but they don't put any effort into finding out what's happening for these fish and wildlife resources, which are really important. They spend a lot of time measuring the timber and those kinds of things, but the interest in doing some work on our other resources is pretty slim. In fact, there's no mention in here that they've even done any surveys in the EIS for sensitive plant species, which is a kind of a requirement of their forest plan also. They have potential for several plant species of concern. Haven't looked for them, or at least they haven't told us that they've looked for them in the EIS. No mention of it. Basically, the Forest Service wants to return back to the 60s, or, I mean, they're doing some things that are a little better than they used to do, but still... they haven't been happy with people challenging their decisions.
One of the things that I noticed in here when we were talking about water quality, and I decided, you know, to take a look at the environmental impact statement, and they had a little chart in here, and they're talking about their water quality objective, and it shows what the objective is. They show what their fish habitat potential was in 1987, and I think that was just a floor because it's all in even numbers. And then they have a percent cobble embeddedness, and I probably should explain to people that's how much sediment is in the cobbles, which is where the fish like to lay their eggs, the larger pieces of rock and gravel, and they call them cobbles. And how much the percent embeddedness shows reflects how much sediment. So if it's 100% embedded, that means there's really not a good place for a fish to lay its eggs. They'd all get smothered. And then the fishery habitat potential in 2012. And they come up with some different numbers here. But the problem is they don't show on their chart whether they're meeting their forest plan water quality objective. They don't say what their objective is for fish habitat potential necessarily, and they only have 1 year where they show a cobble embeddedness, and not only on one stream, it's a small one called Solo Creek. Do they even have some data that shows? Yeah, it's gotten a little bit better. It was 40% covered. The rocks were 46% covered in 93, and in 2012 they say they were 31% covered, but that's the only one. The other streams, and most of the other streams actually have a higher percent of cobble embeddedness, they only have 1 year of data. It's 2012. And so how do they know things are getting better without having information? And how come they're comparing all these, this chart? They should have looked at the water quality values today. They don't show that. They don't show what their fish habitat objective is. They just say potential, and they don't say what what it really is. And it looks like they're kind of not demonstrating what the real condition is out there. They're trying to confuse the people by having a nice chart, but you can't draw any conclusions from it that I can see.
Well, one thing that's interesting to me about that chart, Gary, is they show one stream on there, even by their quickie analysis, that you're discussed there, mm-hmm. They show one stream on there that has a negative trend, according to their own figures. Interestingly enough, they schedule a bunch of timber harvest in that drainage too, so it doesn't seem to make much difference. I don't know. We need some integrity in this system here.
Yeah, wow, do we ever. And we need I think we need some... at least some consistency here, because they don't even say whether or not they're measuring these. You can't compare these two systems at all. And it seems a real problem. One of the other things I noticed, and I'm going to ask you some wildlife questions, obviously, here, is one of the things they don't consider log hauling. And I'm going to provide them with some research papers on the effects of sediment. When you actually take the amount of logs and about how many logs a tree are in a tree, it's going to take 10,000 two-way trips. So it's about 20,000 trips in logging trucks to get these out. And those are those big trucks, with logs on, full logging trucks. Well, that's a tremendous amount of traffic on those roads, and they're going to be cleaning out these ditches, and that's going to mean more sediment. They're going to clean from the vegetation, it's going to more sediment, but they don't even analyze that at all in any of their analysis.
It's pretty interesting, Gary. I worked for the Forest Service for 30 years and actually was proud to work for the organization. But in recent years, it's becoming more of a political organization than it is of a land management agency. And we need good land management, and we need sound timber harvest. And that's what we're asking for is a sound plan a plan that's going to be ecologically defensible. If you ask the Forest Service, they'll tell you their plan is. But it seems to me to be pretty politically driven. And the politics behind it is more logs to the mill.
Well, speaking of wildlife, and I want you to comment on some, there's a couple things that, that concern me. One is, when you look at some of the units, they've got a whole bunch of them that are, you know, they kind of try to separate them out. But when you look at them, they make some pretty giant, I would say, openings. And I'm just wondering how this, you know, very large scale logging might affect wildlife species. And if you could maybe talk a little bit about, I mean, this is, it's big. I mean, that's.
Well, I mean, that's their stated goal, is to make larger openings. What they're doing is they're going in and taking the small patches and leaving some of the bigger patches of older forest alone. But they're connecting all the existing clear cuts together with all the, basically the leaf strips between the clear cuts. They're cutting those out, so then now they'll have a big giant patch. And, that's going to have some effects on lots of different wildlife species. Some species just can't adapt to that. Species like the fisher, for example, it's pretty well known that species is pretty tied to older forest, as pileated woodpecker, goshawks, those kinds of wildlife species. They need these big, large patches of timber where they can be safe from predators, where they can raise their young, and that young can not be disturbed as they're growing up. For example, the goshawks feed their young in an area 600 or 700 acres in size for a couple months after the birds leave the nest. And those birds are very vulnerable if they're in an open setting, because the other predators can actually, other hawks, the great horned owl is a big predator on goshawk young, and they can take those in more open habitat types. Those guys become a lot more vulnerable. So yes, they are going to have some impacts from wildlife. The EIS basically says everything's going to be fine. They kind of rely on what I call the over-the-hill strategy, Gary.
Over-the-hill strategy. I like that name.
It's the over-the-hill strategy. It's okay what we're doing on this project, because there's some more habitat over on the other side of the hill.
Oh, okay.
And so even though they got a big proposal here, they're saying, well, there's more someplace else. The problem with that is that they never identify where the somewhere else is, and they never identify what's happening to the somewhere else. The Nez Perce had some big fires last year and 2012, and they haven't accounted for that in their analysis. There's been past logging practices which they haven't accounted for. They haven't really done a very good cumulative effects assessment in their EIS. In fact, they basically say, well, we don't have the data for the private land, so we're not going to look at it. So if you don't, you know, when I was work on projects, if I didn't have the data, I went out and found some data and tried to make some assessments. I mean, these wildlife species don't, when they come to the land boundary, they don't stop. They go and... they don't know the Forest Service and the private land boundary. So many activities occurring on private land affect the activities that could occur on the Forest Service land and the wildlife species that use those.
I had a couple other questions, too, about wildlife, some of the things that I just I'm a little curious about, Harry, and it comes to, you know, they're going to have these large cuts. Now, they say in there that even though there's going to be large, as they call them, openings, they are saying it's not going to be completely clear cut because they're going to leave a few trees and patches and whatnot. But what happens if you have a small patch of trees and a large opening? Aren't those more susceptible to wind throw, and you might lose them if they're looking to have trees at least in a vertical position versus, you know, down in a horizontal position?
They might lose some, Gary, but I'm not totally against leaving the clumps of trees mm-hmm. and scattered trees. That provides diversity in the new stand as mm-hmm. it grows up. So as the young trees grow up around those trees, they then provide cover around that older tree, and then that could be a nest or something in the future a lot faster than a tree that is a new tree is going to take a couple hundred years to get to the size, say 21 inches, where a pileated woodpecker could use it for nesting. Mm-hmm. They leave a few of those, it's going to be important in the new stand. Mm-hmm. Those scattered trees don't provide much habitat in the current condition. Mm-hmm. They're just scattered trees. They're important for making the stands diverse and structured. If some of them fall down, it's not necessarily a bad thing because a lot of wildlife species use down logs and use that material for their lifestyle. Things like salamanders, you find them under old decaying logs, those kinds of things. So it's not necessarily a bad thing that some fall mm-hmm. down. And I actually think it's an improvement over a straight slicked off clear cut.
Okay.
So
that's a good answer. I was a little bit curious. I guess the question, kind of looking at it from another perspective is, are they leaving enough trees, do you think, to do what needs to be done out there on the landscape long term in an area like this? Because there's an awful lot of logging that is going to take place. Are they going to be leaving enough? I guess that was my question. If they only leave a few and a windstorm comes in and blows them down, obviously it's going to be better than that if they wouldn't have left anything, if they would have slicked it off. But do they even need to leave more? And is there a certain amount that they ought to be leaving?
Well, the answer, I think, in like everything, Gary, is moderation. Mm-hmm. And when you cut this many acres and leave, even if you leave some scattered trees on those acres, you are going to create a very large impact on the animals that live there. You're changing the habitat. You're favoring one animal over another animal. Some animals do better in cut-over areas than other animals. The elk, for example, they have some benefit to having some cutting and those kinds of issues. But even when you put this kind of extent on a small area like we're doing here, you really put a hard conditions on most of the wildlife species that we're concerned about. And that's really what my concern would be. I think if we had a more moderate alternative, we could provide, say, elk forage, for example. If we cut all these units, we're going to provide more forage than the few elk that live there can ever eat in a few years. So what's going to happen is it'll be okay for 10, 20 years, 20, 30 years. Then once all those stands grow up, we'll have a thin young forest, which won't be producing much forage. And then we won't have any other place to go to do some more harvesting that would keep those elk going 20, 30 years from now. So your moderation is the answer to a lot of this stuff. And if we could give the species a half a chance, that they can respond. But if we're going to go for mega projects like we're doing here, nothing's going to be able to survive. And I don't, you know, we hear about fire risk all the time. And, you know, if I pave a parking lot, I've reduced the fire risk. But I don't have much wildlife habitat there anymore. And it's the same idea here in on the forest. If we cut this much acreage, we're going to place a lot of things at risk. That's the bottom line.
Okay. I think that's a great answer. One of the other questions I had is regarding their what they call old growth, and they're going to have an amendment here that allows the Forest Service to change their definitions, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts were about changing definitions, and does it make sense? Although they're not necessarily doing it here, it's a little hard to tell sometimes, even for this giant project. Some of the details get lost in the shuffle. If kind of thinning in these old growth areas really makes sense. The Forest Service in the past, at least in the past here, hasn't allowed any logging and or cutting in the old growth stands, but now there's been a few attempts to do so. So I just kind of wondered your thoughts on both of those, if this new amendment makes sense to try to redefine, I guess, what old growth is, and secondly, is there any place for this so-called restoration or quote-unquote improvement of old growth?
Well, there's a lot of issues there, Gary. They've cited a publication, which I know several of the people who worked on that publication, and they're good folks. Mm-hmm. They put a good effort into trying to help the biologists and ecologists define what old growth is. But that publication, Gary, was meant as a guideline to help professional people make good quality assessments of old growth condition across the landscape. What the Forest Service seems to want to do is to use those basically screen. They were basically set up as a not as a guideline for Forest Service stand definitions. They were set up as a screening tool so that the biologists could get a list of the most probable stands in the drainage that were old growth. The idea was then to go out and check those stands in the field with on the ground boots and make a determination if they were truly old growth. A lot of the guidelines a lot of the numbers in that thing are very minimal screening. And some of the recent cuts of the Forest Service, as long as they left, 10 or so trees per acre, which isn't very many, they can meet those guidelines. But it would be not old growth. It would be a shelterwood type cut or something like that. The Forest Service hasn't done the work to really implement the guidelines. I don't see any reason to actually make it official and put those guidelines in the forest plan, particularly in this case, they're doing the same thing as the soils. They are doing it just specifically for this project. It makes it kind of suspicious. If it's so good, why don't you do it for the whole forest? I don't think they need any reason to do that. As far as the cutting of in the old growth, there are some places, particularly the drier habitats, where we've seen the encroachment of younger trees because wildfire has been excluded from the understory fire because of our fire suppression efforts. Those are generally very dry types. And in our country, it usually occurs on the south-facing slopes of the steep stands along the river. It's a very minor component. Two-thirds of this area is in a more flatter country. It's rolling. It produces cedar-type stands. The cedar stands grow under moist conditions. And the Forest Service takes this strategy from a dry ecological area and tries to apply it to a moist ecological area, and they get things wrong because the moist forest reacts much differently than the dry forest. And what happens in the moist forest is that there's very lots of moisture. The stands thin out over time through competition. They're fast-growing trees. They shade out the understory trees, and it doesn't get thicker over time. It gets thinner over time because, as everybody that's been up to the Elk Creek Cedar Grove knows, that there's not a whole bunch of brush and small trees under the Elk Creek Cedar Grove.
That's right, yeah.
It's an open forest, and that's what happens in the cedar type habitat type. The Forest Service has got confused basically because of a misdirected effort to basically log trees and prevent forest fires. But they haven't considered, they've lost sight of their basic ecology. And you don't take a dry prescription, forest prescription for a dry forest and put it on a wet forest site. That's what they're doing here.
Okay, so we're kind of mixing some basic ecological principles in ways they shouldn't be mixed and coming up with some different and strange results. Earlier you mentioned the fissure, which needs some of these kind of older forests. Of course, it's a relatively rare carnivore. In fact, I think as far as the western United States goes, the healthiest populations really are here in the Clearwater Basin. I know that the fissure on the Pacific are, in the Pacific Mountains, the Cascades and whatnot, aren't doing as well. But the stronghold, at least in the western United States, seems to be this Clearwater Basin. And yet this could have an effect on that species. And when I say stronghold, I'm using that in a more of a subjective sense of the word, because I don't know that any place is considered really a stronghold for fisher, because they're fairly a low density animal.
I think you're right, Gary. I mean, we have large roadless areas. Because these are wide-ranging predators, they need large areas to roam around in to find their food. The other thing about fishers is that they use the moister forest for the most part. And we have that here in the Clearwater and the Nez Perce Forest. We have these moist forests. We have these older forests, and we have these large expanses of land. And that is a combination that does make us have some very good habitat for species like the fissure.
So what other species do you think people ought to at least be concerned about or know about if they're going to take a look at this big document that's about an inch and a half thick or so, and read it, or if they want to write comments to the Forest Service? You talk about the fissures. Is there anything else? You talked about goshawk, I know.
Goshawks, pileated woodpecker, okay. Pine marten, our bat species. There's three or four bat species that use this area.
Oh, okay. So
they need snags, dead trees, those kind of things. There are a few species here that live in the drier forest, probably a little less concern about those because there just isn't that much habitat here for them. I mean, even in the environmental document, they talk about things like the flammulated owl and the pygmy nuthatch, ringneck snake. Mm-hmm. Those animals are generally do find habitat on the drier spots. They would most likely be found down along the river and the south facing areas where there is some ponderosa pine and Douglas fir trees, the drier forest, where the scenario of the understory encroachment is a little more palatable, and that's where that story is appropriate. But that's a small part of this project. Most of the cutting is proposed up in the cedar types, and those are where the old, you know, the things like the goshawk, epileated woodpecker, all those other kinds of species like that, that's where they find their key habitat. So there's a bunch of species that are looked at in the document. I have some real problems that the whole wildlife analysis seems to be based on database queries, which I don't understand where they're coming from. The area has a lot of forest over 21 inches in diameter, according to their vegetation analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I recall, they had like 16,000 acres of old forest. And I think it's for the goshawk. This is just the kind of crazy numbers that they have. They have 16,000 acres of old forest over 21 inches, which should make ideal habitat for the goshawk. But yet they say something in the EIS, there's only 2,000 acres of suitable habitat for the goshawk. And so there's no effect because we're not cutting that 2,000 acres or very little of it. So the wildlife analysis, as I've looked at it, really is suspect. It really doesn't detail out the impacts that are going to occur as a result of the project, from my perspective.
Okay, Harry. And wow. So you've offered us a lot of information here, looking at wildlife species, looking at the various the ecological processes in the area. These are mainly moisture forests, cedar types, not so much the drier forest types.
There is some dry.
There is some dry, but there tends to be
60% or something like that, according to their own numbers.
Okay, so more of it's moist than dry. And yet they still have this big project. We want them to look at this ecologically. It seems like they've done database inquiries rather than field research. And that's one thing biologists need to do is get out in the field. And that seems to be true of both wildlife and also, as near as I can tell, the aquatic information, because they have very little. They do have some, a little bit on cobble embeddedness from 2012 on some streams, but they don't correlate that with past research. So it's hard to know whether or not what's happening in those streams, because they just don't have information. They haven't collected the information, and you're letting us know that it's very, very, very big. You said moderation, and this is not moderate. In fact, what do they call it in the paper, the headlines from the Lewiston Tribune?
Forest Service goes big in timber project.
Okay, they want to go and log a lot. That does not sound like a collaborative effort or a compromise. It sounds like a very, as you noted, a very one-sided event, and makes me wonder what some of the organizations like Idaho Conservation League and the Wilderness Society and others that are supporting, or at least part of this group, are thinking when there's so much weakness in the analysis, and given the fact that right now on the Nez Perce and Clearwater National Forest, they've got a lot of wood that's under contract that they've bought but hasn't been cut. In fact, it's if they didn't sell another timber sale, I think they could probably go on logging at the rates they've been logging in the last few years for about 4 years worth out there. So, you know, I have some serious questions as well about this document. And again, people can get some information. You can go to the Forest Service website, the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forests, and their draft environmental impact statements, Clear Creek Integrated Restoration Project. And what it is, rather than being a restoration project, it's actually a very, very, very large timber sale, and it's huge. They do go big. It's massive. And you can also find some more information at the Friends of the Clearwater website at www.friendsoftheclearwater.org, and we have some information up there about what you can do to comment. Comments are due on June 3rd, so that's, people have a couple weeks, 2.5 weeks about, to comment on this. Not a lot of time, but if you are interested, I would really suggest people out there go and comment on this proposal, because it's huge and it might be the wave of the future. And if it is, it's not just this place that's going to see a big, giant timber sale, and not a moderate one, as Harry said, that the forest could sustain, but a big one. But we'll probably see other places. We're already seeing proposals in a place like Lolo Creek, where they've already logged extensively. Now they want a big one there. So this isn't the only spot.
Yeah, I would remind, I think that's a great point, Gary. People need to look at it for themselves, make their own decision. We're taking our take on it, but they do need to look at it. And there is another big project on the horizon in Lolo Creek that the Forest Service is taking comments on right now. It's not as far along as the Clear Creek project, but it is taking scoping comments, and that has to be in with the next 2 weeks also, Gary.
That's right.
So they've released these things both at the same time, making it more difficult for the average person. Got to spend time wading through a couple hundred pages of this thing, and at the same time they've put another one out in Lolo Creek. And we'll probably talk about that one in another show, but it's even worse because they're going to go into the roadless areas in that one and the riparian areas where the fish live.
That's right, and that's a really bad one, and there will be a draft document, and when that comes out we'll be on the show and talk about that and give people some information on what they can do. And, well, are there any last thoughts that you might have, Harry, for the folks here? And then we can go to a little bit more music and then read the weather again.
I think we've summed it up pretty much. I think that if people are concerned, they need to go to the Forest Service website and take a look at it for themselves. You know, we've covered a lot of ground, but a lot of people I know probably fish and hunt in this area. They're probably more familiar with it than I am because I worked on the Clearwater Forest for most of my career. But you need to get into the document and give the Forest Service some comments.
That's right. And this is the Clear Creek Integrated Restoration Project, it's called. It's a giant timber sale. And it's that country, if you're driving up Highway 12 and you just go past Kooski, where Clear Creek comes in from the right, if you were to take that second bridge into Kooski and then to drive up Tejo Ridge and up there, there's some private land, and then you enter the National Forest way out up on top. So, yes, people do need to comment. Well, I'll take a quick musical break here, and we'll come back and read the weather and move on. So here's another little song about forests and trees rotting in the forest.
I'm not a voice hearing freak, but as I was sitting here last week, listening to my rocking chair squeak, it seemed like it was trying. I like to carve stuff from wood. And I think furniture's really good. But maybe as friends of the woods, we don't do exactly what we should. 'Cause trees like to rot in the forest, so woodpeckers and little animals can have a home. Their trunks growing softer and porous, mingling the xylem with the phloem.
And we are back, the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Do a little bit of weather here and then move on to Between the Lines. And I again want to thank you, Harry, for coming in, talking about this giant project, that just giant timber sale. People do need to comment. If you are concerned about your national forests, please write a letter or send it by email. It looks like what we're looking at for the next few days is pretty much some unsettled weather. They're saying late afternoon and tonight, a 20 to 30% chance of showers. Highs today are projected to be about 64 to 63 degrees right now at the airport. And lows tonight in the mid-40s. Chance of showers on Thursday, about 30%. High 62. Thursday night, partly cloudy. Friday, partly sunny. I'm not sure the difference between partly cloudy and partly sunny. High mid-60s on Friday. Friday night, about a 20% chance of showers. And then on Saturday night and Sunday, looks like increasing to 30% chance of showers on Saturday evening, decreasing to 20%, but increasing again on Sunday to a 40% chance of showers. So it looks like we're in for some more unsettled weather. And you are listening to KRFP Moscow. Now we go to Between the Lines.
KRFP is sponsored by Deadbeat Records, Moscow's underground record store. Deadbeat specializes in new and used vinyl, CDs and tapes, special orders, and concert tickets at 114 and a half East 3rd Street and on Facebook. KRFP is also sponsored by
Ponderosa Rentals, providing quality home rentals since 2006. Ponderosa Rentals proudly supports KRFP Community Radio.
Yo, this is the original Daddy Cool Squadron, KRFP Moscow. Yeah, let's go.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mark J. Cox with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who examines the government's surveillance of Associated Press reporters' phone lines and the Obama administration's plan to overhaul federal surveillance laws. Carlos Warner, an assistant federal defender representing 11 men held at Guantanamo Bay detention camp, who challenges President Obama's inaction in releasing clear detainees and closing the U.S.-run prison in Cuba. And Emma Schuss of the group Earth Justice, who explains